The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Welcome to February 2019. January's in the books with some impressive results. The reflexive mirror markets is what we're calling them. And our guest today, best-selling author and behavioral finance expert, Dr. Daniel Crosby, is with us. All this and much more on episode number 598 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome. It's Andrew Horowitz here, sitting in the seat of the host seat of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me today and each and every week, where we spend some time together and talk to some great guests as we have today and talk about the markets, economy, financial ideas and concepts, as well as a whole host of other items in an attempt to educate you and bring forth some of the things that we think are really important with regard to financial stability and education, outlook, just bring up your financial health. And of course, it's great for me because I get the opportunity to spend time also with some of the greatest people out there in the area of finance, bring them on as guests and learn a lot from them as well. So it's for you. It's also for me. It's also for all of us. We get just a tremendous amount out of this. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on. I'll mention that I did some great fishing yesterday. And if you haven't seen it yet, I tweeted a picture, or actually a video, of the sailfish that we brought in yesterday. Brought in some kingfish as well and some other fish. Really rough out there. It was, I think, 3 to 4 foot seas. Wind was just blasting. It was nice outside, but the wind was coming in really hard. The waves were just smashing us all around. And I was so exhausted. after this particular trip from getting bumped around and slashed around. And we went down to Miami, which is about a 45-minute run in these seas. And being out in the salt water generally takes a little bit out of you as well, you know? So I was so tired that a few hours later when I went to dinner, literally, my eyes were starting to roll up in my head and I was nodding off. It was 9 p.m. I was so exhausted between the sun and the salt and the fishing and the bumping and the waves and the wind. Oy. So anybody that says that fishing, oh, it's not really, it's not a hard sport. You know, it's pretty tough on the body. It can be, at least, not all the time. The kind of fishing we do also is a little bit more intense. So check it out on Twitter. I put this really great video of the sailfish jumping out of the water and doing some acrobatics. And we don't actually bring those fish in. Sailfish, we don't bring in the boat. We don't keep them. You can keep them one a day, I think, with a special permit, which we have, but we don't. Basically, what you do, a confirmed catch, is when you touch the leader, which is the line that goes to the hook, and you touch that, and then you release the fish. It's called a confirmed catch. But it's great action and just a terrific fish to fight. Anyway, let's take a look at what went on during this week. Why don't we? Markets finished higher. Most of the major U.S. indices finished up a bit more than 1%. And a lot of that was due to the Fed's dovish tone, which helped to basically, I guess, soothe investors' fears. You know, it really, investors were waiting with a big, you know, anticipation of, okay, what is the Fed going to do? They seem to be a bit more dovish from their latest discussions, but what are they really going to do in the official rate meeting where they're going to potentially hike rates? They talked about being a little bit more patient. They talked a little bit about this whole idea that they're going to slow down the pace, be more data dependent, and have flexibility. This is what we saw that really was that area of the market in December. We saw that bottoming process go on and this big slam lower, and all of a sudden the Fed comes out and says, well, you know what? Maybe we're not going to be as aggressive with our rate hikes. In fact, on Wednesday, they had their policy rate decision meeting, the announcement for their rate policy. And the FOMC, I think it was unanimous, and the Fed chair, Powell, came out and basically said that, yeah, they were going to continue being patient. And also, more importantly, I think, it is open to curtailing its balance sheet normalization effort if it's necessary. So this is the process that we've been talking about where bonds have been rolling off their balance sheet. They're going to try to take down that $4.5 trillion worth of debt, of bonds, of things that they bought. And they're going to, you know, try to slowly normalize that. But I guess after about 10% normalization, where they took it from about $4.5 trillion down to $4 trillion, they're going to possibly slow that down because they realize that they're sucking liquidity out of the markets faster than it can be dealt with. And what's happened is that markets are not cooperating. So the Fed has definitely put a bit of a floor underneath that, or net, a safety net, if you want to call it, underneath markets right now. Unless we see some significant rolling over of economic news and the Fed being very aggressive again, which they could turn it back on very quickly. I think that investors believe that there is some kind of a floor and some kind of a helping hand that's being provided by the Fed. So we did also have a big week of earnings that was there. We saw about half of the Dow Jones Industrial Average report. It's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, we saw the good news out of Apple and Boeing, and Apple was questionable. They beat. Okay, that was good. However, if you look at what they beat, it was on significantly reduced estimates that were brought down over the last 90 days. From about $4.94 to $4.17 per share, and they beat by one penny, $4.18 where they came in. Boeing, 3M, Pfizer, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Merck, investors were pretty happy with their results. On the other hand, we saw names like Microsoft and Visa, Caterpillar. Who else was it? DuPont, McDonald's, Verizon. Investors weren't as thrilled with those names. Amazon, at the end of the week, put a little bit of a damper on the NASDAQ as they came in with, I guess the best way to describe it would be tepid guidance. Their outlook was not at all very exciting. And even though they had a decent quarter and things looked pretty good overall, their outward guidance, due to some spending that they say they're going to do, going back to the spending process, is really spooked investors. Shares were down like 5%. We also saw Facebook. Facebook was interesting because there was a lot of negativity going into, myself too, going into the print. And they beat, they had some decent things to say, and the shares just had one of the best days they've had in years. GE also did very well. We know that GE's expectations are zero. I mean, nobody has anything to say good about GE. So probably what happened there was the short said, you know what? If we're starting to see better numbers here, expectations are so low, earnings estimates have been cut to levels that were just ridiculous. And this is the kind of process that we see on a regular basis. On the economics front, we saw that the unemployment rate, which really kind of stuck out to me, the whole unemployment report, the unemployment rate jumped up to 4%. Okay, that's, you know, that moves around a bit, but it's up from about 3.7%, which we saw recently. We saw a much better addition than expectations. However, one of the things that really was there that we had to kind of take a look at, and I think it bears some question, is the revision. The revision from last month was, if you remember last month, it was a blowout number. We saw 312,000 added last month, and that was revised down to 222,000. Significant revision to the downside. I'm not sure what that means right now, but we'll have to see if this number also gets revised down, and maybe there was some, you know, wonky accounting done in their process of bringing us this economics report, in particular regarding the health of the economy related to employment. Consumer sentiment continued to see a downward trend, and the expectations component seemed to be coming in pretty hard. You know, you saw that a few reports showed that the expectations number was one of the lowest move, the biggest moves lower that we've seen in years. So the outward expectations on what the economy is going to be and how that relates to my personal situation from this particular report. And next week is a couple of reports that are due, but generally a light week overall when it comes to economics. Over the next couple of weeks, there's going to be plenty of names reporting earnings. We saw about 50% of the Dow, 50% of the S&P 500 report last week, and it's going to still roll in pretty significantly over the next couple of weeks. Now, before I go any further, I want to mention, in the beginning of the show, we talked about this reflexive mirror action that we see with markets. Sometimes you think of it, it's this V-shaped recovery where markets go down, basically straight down or very swiftly down, and then move straight up. Now, there's a couple of things that I want to look at here. Basically, in December, the S&P went down, pretty much straight down, 16% in 14 trading days. From the low, from that point, it's up 16% in 25 trading days. Now, not an exact V, but we are seeing that formation of that reflexive mirror trade to where we are today. So we saw that big move up recently, we know. Now, we still need about 3.5% to get back to the top of where we were in December, not the top, but where we were in December, or about a total of 20% to get back to where we were in December when it started moving down. So we came down 16%. We need about 20% to recover. So look at it this way. If you start with $100 and you lose 50%, ask yourself, how much in percent do you need to get back to $100? No, it's not 50%. It's 100%. If you're down $50 from 100, you need to get 100% on the 50, right, to get back to 100. And what I want to mention is market sentiment is what's involved in this whole process here, this whole reflexive V mirror action, and it can change just like that. And even though there's many reasons that it may go down, and there may not be many reasons, one of the big things is sentiment. It plays an important role, really important part of the overall psyche when it comes to price and markets. It's not the only cause. It's not the only reason why prices move. You have fundamentals. You have technicals. But market psychology is really a key area to understand. So the question is, with all this volatility that we've seen, this crazy movement towards the end of the year, that was basically the end of the calm, how are you dealing with all this? I mean, what are you thinking about markets? What does that do to your decision-making process as you see this volatility? This is precisely why I want to bring on an expert in the area of market psychology today to talk about this, because I think it's really important to understand not only how markets operate in terms of sentiment and psychology and behavioral finance, but also how do you deal with it? How do I deal with it? How do we deal with it? So let's get right in with that discussion. And our guest today is Dr. Daniel Crosby. He's a best-selling author and expert in the area of behavioral finance. So Dan, congratulations on your latest book, The Behavioral Investor. I told you I'm about halfway through and I think it's fabulous.
Yeah, thanks very much.
A lot of research and time. How long did it take you to write that?
It's tricky to say. I mean, it took me 3 months to write it once I sat down. But like at that point, all the research is already harvested. It's already well outlined. All your ducks are in a row. So it takes a very long time to sort of map it all out. But once it's all mapped out, it took me about 3 months of actual writing.
Wow. It's great stuff. I mean, there's some wonderful look at research, analogies, understanding, and almost you almost press the reader to do a lot of self reflection and, you know, go through a process of understanding what it is that is being said and how you react to this. So how do you deal with this? So you seem to, I don't know if that was the intent, but you push the reader to really better understand themselves. Was that some of the intent?
Yeah, you're picking up what I'm putting down, because one of the things that I found among behavioral finance enthusiasts is that a lot of us, and, you know, I'll include myself in that group, we read these books about how silly and, you know, wayward and irrational people are. And we go, wow, you know, I totally know a guy, or, you know, that's just like my friend. We do everything but turn that bright light of introspection back in on upon ourselves. So I try throughout the book to say, look, you are the problem. Like, this is about you. this isn't about you identifying other people's foibles. This is your problem as much as anyone's problem.
So I guess the big question before we start on this to give us the baseline of this discussion is, so you're a behavioral finance expert. What makes you an expert?
What makes me an expert? You know, what's funny is a field like behavioral finance, that's such a mutt. It sits at the intersection of psychology and finance and economics and sociology and social psych. I think it's an open question what makes someone an expert. You know, I could say my PhD in psychology is why a lot of people hire me. But candidly, I don't use an ounce of what I learned getting a PhD in psychology every day or when writing books like these. So just about everyone who is a so-called expert in behavioral finance is going to come from one of these disciplines or another that lay some sort of claim to the field. But then they're going to be more or less self-educated in those other fields that they're not expert in. And so, I've got as much claim as the next person, perhaps. But it's easy to be an expert when the field is so multifaceted that no one can probably get all of it nailed down.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this. In the book, you talk about the four primary types of decision errors. You talk about the idea of attention and ego, emotional conservatism. And let's kind of get into that a little bit about what each of those mean and how they actually provide the input for us outputting errors.
Yeah. So what I did is I looked at this universe of investor misbehavior and I found, hundreds of different experts, right? People who are trying to make a name in the field. People had identified hundreds of different cognitive biases and wayward heuristics. And I said, look, these aren't all that important. And so what I did was I tried to drill down and see what are the handful or two handfuls of things that underlie all of these behavioral errors that we talked about. And those were the four that I came up with in my research. So, the first, ego, is, we move through the world and we have a vested interest in thinking that we are smarter, luckier, better than the next person. And this gets in the way of us making good financial decisions.
So you're telling me that I'm not smarter than everybody? Is that what you're saying? I'm confused.
Well, I'm telling you that I'm telling you that you might be smarter than everyone, right? You might be smarter than everyone, but I am telling you that everyone thinks they're smarter than everyone else. And a lot of times there's an inverse relationship between how smart you think you are and how smart you actually are. I talk about the Dunning-Kruger syndrome in the book, which is probably my favorite of all psychological biases. It was named after the two researchers who discovered it. And the way that they discovered it was a bank robber robbed a bank covered in lemon juice.
Oh, this is hysterical.
Right. And right. So when they get this guy out and they're like, how were you going to walk into this bank covered in lemon juice and think you're going to get away with this? And he goes, well, when I was a kid, we use lemon juice to make invisible ink, so I figured the lemon juice would make me invisible as well. And
I mean, that's so crazy, yeah. Crazy. But when you look at this whole idea of ego, and does that possibly provide a little more of a bias towards, I believe I'm right, therefore what I'm doing is right? And when we term it into the discussion of the market, is that like, hey, the market should be going down. I believe it's going down. It's going up. It's not right. I'm right. I'm going to stick to what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah, no, it definitely manifests that way. And what Dunning and Kruger found is that basically dumb people were too dumb to know how dumb they were, and that smart people were just smart enough to be insecure. They were smart enough to have an acute understanding of all their insecurities. And so, yeah, ego gets in the way with markets in all sorts of ways. It can lead us to believe that our political leanings should play out in the markets. It can lead us to believe that to hold overly concentrated positions, to do what you talked about and sort of double down and wait for the market to agree with our correct opinion. I think there's all sorts of all sorts of people who love to hate on the Fed who have for a decade been waiting for the market to come to its senses. And that's ego.
Yep. What about attention?
So attention is this idea that we don't weigh things in terms of how likely they are. We weigh them in terms of how salient they are. And salience is just sort of a fancy psychological term for how easy it is to remember something. So my favorite example from the book about attention has to do with the fact that there are disproportionately more deaths by selfie than by shark attack. And yet people are scared of sharks and not scared of taking selfies when one is, you know, about 50 times more dangerous than the other. And so this happens all over the place. You know, every day we do dangerous things that we don't think twice about. You know, we eat it. We eat greasy food. We drive to the store. And then we freak out about things like swimming in the ocean or flying on an airplane, both of which are, you know, enormously safe. So this attention is this idea that we confuse recall with likelihood.
And this is a story you also bring up, might I say, in the book, that there was a time that you were doing one of your first jobs down in Hawaii. And I believe the story goes something like this, that you were ready to do things. You were excited about being in Hawaii, all the things you want to do of scuba diving and snorkeling and doing things in the water and all this. And just at that given time or thereabouts, the Shark Week hit TV. You you watch this Shark Week and then you decide, I'm not going in the water. Now, did you ever go in the water?
I did not. Ugh. No, I was there for 5 months. Never went swimming.
Oh, God. Well, hopefully you're over that. Let's talk about emotion, because there's a debate. And I think the debate is interesting because on one hand, you look at chartists, technical analysts, people that are really just looking at price and looking at trend and momentum. And they, at the core, many of them believe that emotion plays no part in any investment decision at all. Now, I've read other people's discussions like Denise Scholl, and she writes about emotion is very important to look at. You know, emotion is something that you want to pay attention to because, you know, it is possibly giving you proper signals and things that are in your subconscious that you may not be recognizing.
So one of this emotion section was the reason I decided to write the whole book, because I felt like there was a lot of misinformation about emotion and intuition and the ways that they can serve investors or traders. So there's a couple of points that we need to make. One is there is some evidence that human beings can develop intuition. There's a fascinating story in the book where we talk about drawing from two decks of cards. You know, one is a fair deck and one is a loaded deck. And even before people can articulate verbally which one they understand to be the fair deck and which one they understand to be the loaded deck, their palm starts to sweat on the loaded deck. So this is evidence, right? There's evidence that there's this intuition that we can start to sense. And I cite a couple of other interesting studies about, you know, the presence of intuition. But what we find is intuition is best applied in a couple in fields where there are a couple of things that are consistent. One is that there's a lot of reliable information. And two is that information can be deemed to be good or bad in relatively short order. So I give the example of some NICU nurses who were able to judge the illness of a baby before the tests even could, before the formal tests and diagnostics could, because they had had so much experience. So they had had lots of experience, lots of data, and you knew very quickly whether that baby was well or ill. I argue in the book that markets do not provide along the correct timeline the same sort of information, right? You might buy a stock and not know for years or months whether it was a good choice or a bad choice, because I think people who are doing this right, are taking a longer term approach, and you really don't know for a very, very long time whether you got the right result for the wrong reason, the wrong result for the right reason, or whether your purchase was bad or good. And so I argue in the book that, yeah, there is some evidence that emotion can help us in other domains, but I say it's a misfit for application to financial markets.
Unless you recognize as a behavioral finance expert that emotions do in fact drive some of the underlying markets in a short-term basis and understand that such that you can trade appropriately with it.
I think the biggest benefit that comes from an understanding of emotion is putting strictures in place that keep you from making bad emotional decisions. You know, I think that understanding these things is your first line of defense against doing something dumb, and you can just automate the right processes. But I really don't buy much into this sort of trader's intuition thing. And I think that a lot of what gets labeled as trader's intuition is either luck or skill that we're calling premonition.
But what I'm talking about is understanding the emotion of the masses. Understanding that most people cannot put that into a sequence and an understanding and looking at it objectively. Right.
Absolutely. Yes.
They see a bad earnings number come out on a stock, a fire that the company caused, a dam that breaks or whatever it is. And you know that there's going to be a lot of just craziness. And once that craziness hits a crescendo, it's going to get really crazy to a point that maybe like what we saw in December, that people are just like, OK, I'm done. The capitulation point. And once you can understand that, it is, again, I'm talking about shorter term trading timeframes. Is possibly something if you understand that most people can't control their emotions, that's what I'm trying to say, okay? And don't understand their emotions, that you can actually benefit from that.
Yeah, your ability to control and to harness your own emotions is an entirely different topic. And you're exactly right, that your ability to control your emotions, your ability to take a contrarian viewpoint is absolutely to your benefit. I'm talking about, you know, can you have a sixth sense that a stock will zig or zag? And I'm saying you cannot.
Yeah, I gotcha. And last thing is conservatism.
Yeah, so conservatism is our tendency to conflate what we know with what's safe. And so you see this in things like home bias. You see this in people's tendency to confuse what they like to do with what is actually fun. Or with what is actually safe, rather. You see something like boating. You know, people love to go boating. Boating's very risky, but people don't think of boating as risky because they enjoy it. Investing in the markets over, you know, the right time horizon is actually not all that risky, but people perceive it as being risky because it's no fun for a lot of people, probably the listeners of this show excepted. So yeah, that's just this tendency to confuse what we know with what's safe.
So I want to talk about this because you just brought up a topic here that was sent off something on me, this whole discussion of home bias. Now, recently, you and I are Twitterites, and so we follow along a bunch of probably the same people. And recently, Meb Faber has been talking about this whole home bias. He's all over this home bias thing, right? Have you seen it?
Yep, okay. I read it.
And I was thinking about it. I commented on this. I'm like, I get it. The problem is there's an underlying flaw in the thesis, in my opinion. And that is that there is a home bias due to the fact that you live in a certain country and you believe that everywhere else is risky because you're not there. Now, meanwhile, let's just say that you lived in Italy. Well, you probably have a home bias for Italy because it's there. It's you know, you see things safe here. You don't know what's going on with the, you know, what's happening with the situation with maybe the markets in another country, whether it's US, whether it's Latin America, whether it's China. So you're probably going to feel safer about the companies that you know and things you're more comfortable with, right? So far, that's pretty much the scenario.
Yep.
Okay. However, my problem is this. He actually put up something about, wow, look at Latin America. Latin America has a really significant home bias. Now, if we just stop there and look at it like, oh, yeah. You know, the problem with this is that when you live in a certain country, you may not have access to other vehicles to invest outside of that country on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And I think he and others also cited Latin America as a place that gave huge tax incentives for investing in Latin American companies. So, you know, you've got to take that into account as well. But in developed countries, I spent the summer in Canada. I spent the summer in Western Canada.
Sorry.
No, it was nice. Great. Okay. It was wonderful. Uh-huh. And I'll tell you, Western Canada beats Georgia in July.
True.
But, you know, when we were in Canada, and they certainly have access to, you know, to all sorts of investment vehicles, they had 80 to 90% of their wealth. Most folks I met there had 80 to 90% of their wealth in Canadian stocks. And, you know, that leaves you overweight maple syrup and commodities, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so It's if you have options and, you know, holding extenuating circumstances like tax alpha aside, I still think it's a mistake that most people make.
I agree with you, by the way. And I've always tried to discuss this with, it's hard to explain to clients sometime, Because I've had clients like, I don't want international. I'm like, why? It's risky. What? What? Why? How, where? What international? And, you know, first of all, it's old line thinking because it was a lot less efficient to invest internationally than it is today. But more importantly, I tried to explain to them this whole idea that it is your perception from where you sit on what is aggressive and what may be beneficial. And I think they look at it not so much as what the potential for gains are, but they're really looking at, oh, that's risky and I'm concerned about losing money because I don't know about the government there and currency issues and I can't calculate all this. And I think that's where the problem comes in. So we try to, of course, diversify across many different countries, whether it's blocks in emerging markets or in the international and the U.S. As a matter of fact, we're weighted a bit heavier right now on the ex-U.S., which is kind of interesting. We haven't been that way for a while. But I just thought there was a couple of things in there that kind of was like, I'm not sure I totally agree with that. But
well,
anyway.
It is worth thinking about and discussing, though. There are some countries that I would not invest in. I mean, there are some countries that just because of their accounting standards and, and you know, their politics and their lack of transparency, I would not choose to invest in those countries.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's a fair conversation that you have to tease apart from, well, I don't know. I've never been to Norway, so, you know,
right,
so why would I invest there,
right,
you know?
Right, exactly. So a couple other things here. You discussed the power of the story in your book. And it's interesting because back, you're a little bit younger than I am, back in the old days, the way that you would work with a stockbroker is he'd call you, usually whisper something. He'd be in a, you know, hey, listen, I talk to you about something. I got this stock and this company is on the breakthrough opportunity. This is before everything was either compared to Apple or Google, right? Oh, it's the next Apple, it's the next Google. It is before that. They're on the next breakthrough for a cancer drug or something like that. And you know what I got to tell you? Nobody really knows about this. There's something coming out, you know, by the FDA soon and this and that. I really think you should get into this. And the manager from this company used to work for Pfizer and blah, blah, blah. You know, they give you this story and that's how they sold you on it. And it worked pretty well, by the way. How can you say no to something like that? So you talk about the idea of the story and how it helps to either sell something or to familiarize people with the product. And you gave the example of Coca-Cola over Pepsi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the favorite study out of the story portion of the book is a study out of Princeton that looked at people's brain activity. So you and I are sitting across from each other. We're talking about numbers. We're talking about whatever. We're talking about sports, and they look at my brain and they look at your brain and our brains look very different. Well, then you start to tell me a story and they look at our brains in an fMRI and our brains look exactly the same. So story has this preternatural process of just opening up your brain and putting it inside the brain of the person you are conversing with. It bypasses critical thinking. It bypasses reason and goes straight to emotion, and you effectively are locked in your mind, right?
Right.
When it comes to Coke, right? When it comes to Coke, and you think about the cola wars, and you think I talk in the book too about Coke's flub with New Coke. People loved it. Like people loved it. They loved it three times as much as Coke Classic. But it didn't have all the story behind it. And so people thought that Coke thought that people would like it because they liked it better in blind taste tests. They said, well, hey, when we make it available to the masses, you know, if they like it three times better in blind taste tests, they're going to buy three times as much of it. And it wasn't the case because it lacked all of the story of Coke Classic, which had for, you know, 100 years been tied in with Santa Claus and the flag and every, you know, and apple pie. And so story is critical to the way that we think about things, and it can be used for good or ill. You know, it can be used, we can use stories to help our clients make better financial decisions by helping them understand or comprehend a complicated concept. But just as surely we can be sold a crummy penny stock by a boiler room broker who's whispering in our ear.
So the, there's some interesting discussion on, it seems that when we talk about making decisions that you had, it wasn't a very big section, but you had a discussion on the more time we spend on making decisions, the more warped our sense of what is right may become. So thinking about getting back to the investing side of things. We think that, okay, this is an interesting investment. I look at it, I do the study and all that. And then you start thinking, I guess this goes into the question of I'm not sure. Because if you're sure, you make the decision quickly, right? Mm-hmm. So why does that happen? Why is that you get a different sense of the decision, if it's right or wrong, the more time that you spend on thinking about it?
Well, a couple of things happen when we spend more time and take in more information. And so I cite a couple of places in the book. I talk about how more information can lead us to making worse decisions. And they showed this with horse racing, with betting on ponies. They found this with college football, that they give people, you know, 5 pieces of information, 25 pieces of information, and 50 pieces of information. Their predictive ability does not increase in the least, but their confidence does. And so when that confidence increases, the ego increases, and it's more likely to lead you to take an oversized bet or to be overconfident, right? And what we also find is when there's 50 pieces of information, people can't discern the important pieces from the unimportant pieces. And so I'm a big advocate for, you know, figuring out the signals that matter to you and relying on those signals and ignoring everything else. The other reason that more time and more information can be to our detriment is because it increases the amount of sunk costs, right? I give a whole list in the book of horrible events that have happened because people have fallen prey to this sunk cost fallacy. You know, let's say you've spent a week researching a stock. If you're an analyst, you did a site visit, you met the, you know, you met the CEO, you spent a week and a half on site trying to decide if you want to make a buy or not. You get back from that, and if you decide not to make a buy, you wasted that time, is the thought, right? You know, you didn't really waste that time. But the more time people spend, the more information they take in, the steeper the sunk costs become. And people have a hard time not falling prey to that sunk cost.
Because you feel like that, you know, I did all this work already and all that. How bad can it be? I got that far in the process.
Exactly.
And that last step, maybe I got to the factory and there was some question about, there was no production going, well, maybe it was just an off day.
Yep.
You know, maybe it was something that I didn't see. Maybe there's another factory that's doing a little bit better. I don't know. Let's just pause for a second. And at this point, tell me, how can we as investors look to better our understanding what our biases are and how to work with them? In other words, identify what my bias is, understand what my bias is, and then make sure that I don't have too much of that in my process.
Yeah, the first thing that you can do, I think, is, and probably the most important, is to surround yourself with a psychologically diverse group of friends who are not afraid to tell you what's what. Because, you know, I would love to say, look, go buy my book, read it, you know, scan the book for evidence of wrongdoing in your own life. And I think that can get you part of the way. But we see ourselves, you know, through a glass darkly, as it were. And so it's oftentimes only in interactions with other people that these biases are made manifest. So a good friend or a spouse or a partner who can let you know gently, like, hey, you know, you kind of do this or that, I think is an invaluable resource. Or a mentor, you know, someone who fulfills that role in your professional life. And, you know, I don't, you know, I said earlier in the show that I don't use a lot of what I went to school for. I was trained as a clinical psychologist. I don't use a lot of that schooling in my day-to-day life. But one of the things that I had to do in my program was I had to watch video of myself doing therapy sessions in front of all of my other classmates.
Oh, and don't go on. Don't. Yeah. Oh, this sounds awful.
No, but just, you know, just the way that an athlete watches, you know, watches them take swings or whatever, you watch this and see where you screwed up, and everyone goes, ooh, you could have done that better. And, you know, at first you're very defensive and you're very upset. And then, you know, over the course of 4 years, they wear you down. So learning to be non-defensive has been a great benefit to me as a professional. And it's something we can all learn and take with us.
Okay, so now I want to get into another discussion because, again, another favorite. I mean, when I say favorite, if I could think of some of the all-time favorite discussions of the gang on Twitter is the phrase confirmation bias. Man, that is just bantered around like crazy, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm part of it too. I mean, we're all part of it to a degree, right? So, but it's interesting because one of the things I find really fascinating about this is that it seems that the discussion about confirmation bias, when they basically go and look at somebody's tweet of some sort or report and say, hey, here's a classic example of confirmation bias. And then someone else is saying, oh, yeah, that I agree with that. And yes, look at this confirmation bias. I wonder if the whole confirmation bias, first of all, I want you to explain what that is continually being, I guess, it's part of an echo chamber that then becomes confirmation bias on itself. Does that make any sense? Right.
Yeah, it's confirmation bias inception, right? It's a right. confirmation bias within one, within another. It's a nesting dolls of confirmation bias.
Right.
Yeah. So confirmation bias is the tendency, it's our propensity to seek out information that agrees with stuff we already believe in, right? So this is something we're all prone to. A good example of this, which is, of course, a bad thing, is that in the last presidential election, a majority of Trump voters and Clinton voters both did not have a single friend who was voting for the non-preferred candidate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we segregate ourselves, you know, intellectually, we segregate ourselves philosophically and in a variety of other ways. And then we just think that everyone believes the same things that we do. And the reason that we do this is because it is cognitively taxing to change your mind. Like it's really tough to change your mind and to say, oh, I might be wrong. And so the way that we do this, I talk in the book about how your brain only accounts for about 2% of your body weight, but accounts for 25 to 40% of the calories that you burn every day. So one of the ways that we do this, we're always looking for ways to conserve our thinking. And one of the ways that we do this is that we surround ourselves with these echo chambers. And you know, Twitter has made it very easy because almost by default, you follow people who you like.
Yep.
Follow people who you want to listen to, and you don't follow the other guy. And I think the specificity of the various news channels has made this very easy too. I mean, it used to be, you know, you had the couple of major networks running more or less a centrist news program every night at dinner, and now you can, you know, you can watch your liberal news or your conservative news or any other flavor you'd like. And so it really allows us to self-select into these echo chambers. You're absolutely right.
And that's a problem because you'll never learn and grow if you don't do it. One of the things that I suggest, and I mentioned this, is, you know, tools and techniques to start the day, to have a clear mind and to understand what's happening around you. One of the things, you know, you could do things like eating right. Maybe you want to do some yoga or meditation, or maybe do some exercise, or I don't know, something you want to do. One of the other things that I always do and I suggest to do is to try, it's not always easy, try to find opposing opinion to whatever topic you're thinking of, right? News is the easiest one to go for. So if you are a hardcore liberal left and you like CNN and you want to see just the all I hate Trump network, you know, do their thing, maybe that's your thing. But you know what? Every once in a while, slip over to Fox or maybe watch Bloomberg TV, which is a little slightly more balanced, or something else out there, maybe even PBS, something that has a difference to what your belief is, to get maybe just another opinion. Of course, the problem is that you'll discount everything you're listening to, but it's something that at least you can get both sides of the opinion. Don't you think it's a good idea?
I think it's a great idea, and it's something I think you'll be surprised how painful it is too.
It's painful.
Because when I'm in a hotel, you know, I'm trying to eat my own cooking here. So I've got my preferred news channel, which is CNN, part, you know, in no small part because of my political leanings, and then also because I live in Atlanta and you support the hometown folks. But, you know, I'll try and watch MSNBC or Fox, and I find them both very painful to watch. And, it, you know, but it's interesting. It's interesting. It lets you know where you sit, and it exposes you to different ideas. Jack Forehand of Validia actually wrote a great article this week. They're a factor investing shop, so they have value ETFs and things like that. And he wrote a piece this week called, you know, if value is dead, this is why, basically. And he took this cherished belief of his that value investing is a, you know, a smart way to go to market. And he said, here are whatever it was, 8 or 10 reasons why, you know, value may really be broken. It may really be dead and it may not work anymore. And he didn't try and argue for his side. And I thought that was a really,
That's difficult.
Yeah, it was very humble and a very smart exercise, I thought.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, you talk about this confirmation bias and the belief of what we want to hear. And people want to be told what they already know versus something different. You know, I wrote a piece about 3 months ago on trying to look at, on a I do this regularly, look at things. I try to look at, okay, we have a particular sector in the market. What's the best way to invest from a broad-based, diversified approach? So let's look at, pick whatever you want, pick domestic U.S. stocks, pick international, and let's look at actually a performance on many different levels, net performance on many different levels, and look at things like various, you know, Morningstar style box and Sharpe ratios, and look at the alpha and the beta. Just look at a variety of different things across the board and compare them to ETFs, core ETFs. And I found that, which I thought I'd find, but that's another discussion. But, I, you know, in there are some areas that even though mutual fund fees are higher, they perform much better over time with either the same or less risk. And I put this piece out there and I kind of hit some of the people that I know that are really ETF focused and it's all about the low cost. And yes, we use institutional funds in our studies and individual funds. We split it up. We use base returns. We use rolling returns. We use long-term and short-term. And what I found was there was very little conversation about it because it went against the basic principle that ETFs are the only way to be.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I love about capital markets is that they resist easy characterization. But that doesn't stop people from falling into camps like their religions,
right?
You know, there's the ETF religion and the value religion and the momentum religion. And it's capital markets don't lend themselves to these pigeonholes and these easy characterizations. And so I tried in my book to be an equal opportunity destroyer of you know, of both passive and active approaches to investing and try to critique both. And I've taken some heat for that. But you know, that's a hill that I'll die on because I think that we're silly to foreclose on other ideas and just fall into this camp based on a couple of cherished ideas. And so, yeah, I think you're doing God's work there, trying to look at this with an open mind and ask hard questions. It's what we should all be about, and it's one of the things that makes investing so much fun.
Yeah, I gotta say, I don't know if I sent you that report. I'm gonna send you that little piece we did.
Here's
a question. I don't know if you talked about this or I don't know. I have this separate question on brain muscle memory. Did you talk about that in the book?
I don't think so. I talk a lot about the brain, but I don't remember any direct correlation to muscle memory.
Yeah, this is not a Prevagen commercial, by the way, where it was discovered in jellyfish. But you know, here's the thing about brain muscle memory. I want your comments on this. So you drive to work, you get there, and you know what? You don't even remember driving. That's happened to you, right?
Yeah.
Like I got here, somehow here. So what happens when you go to do something? You start driving and somehow you arrive at work, but that wasn't your intended location, right? Same thing. I had an intention first to go to work, got there somehow, not even thinking about it. I don't even remember if I had any stoplights. I don't even remember what happened, but I somehow got there. Now, on the other hand, you get the same process. You start driving with your intention to go to Denny's. But somehow you arrive at work. You follow me so far?
I mean, Waffle House, not Denny's.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. I gotcha. So I would kind of call that a brain muscle cramp, right?
Sure.
That you kind of. Now, what happens the same process when you're like, okay, my brain is telling me that I should do a certain thing. I start buying in and all that. I go long on this position and all that. But all of a sudden, you know, I start going kind of askew. Markets are starting to go down, but my brain muscle is keeping me in the buy mode. How do I kind of clear myself so that I'm aware and I'm not just going by rote of just buying when I should be shorting or vice versa, or staying away or not buying this particular type of stock? In other words, how do I stop from these cramps happening?
Yeah. So I'm going to take a small diversion, a small digression, and get back to your question. So we used to think that brains, you know, there was a period of neuroplasticity, like you could change your brain for this short window of time when you were a kid. And then once it was set, and then, you know, you're just kind of losing neurons from there on out, and you're screwed. Like if you haven't, you know, if you haven't learned your lessons by the time you're five or six. What we know now is that brains continue to be plastic much longer than we think, even though there is a degree of calcification over time. And what we find is the more you think in a certain direction, you effectively wear deeper grooves, if you'll think of it in a simplified way. You know, that repeated thought process wears deeper grooves in your brain and makes it easier for you to think that way. So I talked earlier about how the brain is so metabolically expensive and we're always looking for ways to take shortcuts. That's what's happening when, you know, you're trying to drive to the gym and you accidentally drive to work, because they're, you know, they're both places where you go a lot and you slipped into the wrong sort of neural river. So the thing that you have to do there to get out of this is to do the thing that we talked about in the previous segment, which is to expose yourself to new ways of thinking, to look at problems from different angles over time, to break your own rut so that you have that cognitive flexibility when you need it. You've got to get in the habit of approaching a problem from these different angles, mixing up your process, or else you're going to be doomed, and it's going to be, you're going to drive to the wrong place just the way that you did in your car.
Yep. And just think that as a metaphor for markets, I guess is the big point there. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming and for a great book, The Behavioral Investor, another bestseller by you. You can find that on Amazon and all sorts of other places. I know it's available on Kindle. The other thing I want to mention to you is, even though you said that fishing is, or that boating is a dangerous sport, hobby, activity, the next time you get down to Florida, you got to come on my boat and we got to go fishing, because we're going to snap you out of, and maybe we'll get a shark. You know, we can fish for a shark. We're not going to go, boat's big enough. You don't have to worry about it. No, Jaws isn't coming. Maybe we can break you. We can even go scuba diving if you like, or is that not happening?
Scuba, you know what? I'll do it. Ah. I'll do it. I'll do it to just be a probabilistically minded individual and to eat my own cooking. I'll do it. And you know what? Living in Georgia, it's like in the mid-20s here today. So I'll go to Florida whenever you want.
Yeah, you come down this summer. We'll go to a little place, nothing fancy. Go to a little wall. We'll do a little bit, you know, 20, 30-foot dive. And we'll do a little fishing, spend the day in the boat. Anytime you're down to Fort Lauderdale, you look me up. How's that?
I'll be there in April. It's on.
All right, there you go. Daniel Crosby, best-selling author and expert in behavioral finance. And, of course, The Behavioral Investor. And as I've told you before, and I'll tell you again, I don't know who makes your covers, but you just want to put it up against your cheek and rub it all day. It's very soothing.
The Rorschach is cool too, right? The
ink. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That too. You stare at that all day. Like, wow, what is that? What is that, by the way?
Gotten a lot of inappropriate comments on what it is that I won't say. It's all a bull. In my mind, it's a bull.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. And that's a wrap. I think that was a pretty cool discussion, learning more about and maybe hopefully touching you a little bit in the area of the areas that can help you understand about yourself, how you deal with things in terms of risk, markets, news, headlines, maybe what other people are telling you and tips. Great, great, great thing to try to better ourselves by understanding more about how we operate on a regular basis and understand how some of these emotional aspects and the psychology behind it really push our buttons to make us do things that we may want to do or may not want to do. I encourage you to pick up his book, The Behavioral Investor. I'll have links to it on the show notes for episode number 598 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, I hope you enjoy your week. Have a safe, fun-filled, profitable, wonderful week with you and yours. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you then.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.